Revived Thoughts is a production of Revive Studios.
This is Troy Angel, and you are listening to Revived Thoughts, Revived Conversations.
That's right. Revive Conversations is a episode where Troy and I just talk about stuff. We talk about things in the context of church history. There's no sermons in these episodes. It's more of just Troy and I marveling at what we've learned from church history and how that might apply to modern day conflicts, modern day scenarios, modern day theology in ways they are often very fun, hopefully thought-provoking conversations. Troy came at me this week with this idea. Troy, do you want to set us up?
Yeah, so let me just go ahead. If you've listened to the show for a while, you may be kind of aware that I run what little social media presence that this podcast has, which is almost completely on Twitter, because that's really all I have time for is that one. And occasionally, as one does when they're on Twitter, they send things out to the world that accidentally cause controversy. Well, maybe not accidentally. I mean, you put out opinions and you're on Twitter. It's not uncommon to cause controversy.
It's built around controversy.
It's literally, yeah, it's like a social media. If you're not causing controversy to a degree, you're not getting noticed. Maybe people who follow me would feel differently. I don't feel like I'm a flamethrower. I actually try not to go out of my way not to be the bombastic guy. I just don't think that's what, you know, Christ has called us to be online. I feel like our words in person and our words online should match. Actually, a lot of my students have found my show and they have found my Twitter, and I've never had any of them go like, wow, you're really different. I did have a couple
Who
of them
you?
Tell me one time. Yeah, I did have a couple of them tell me one time, you like to put up old man memes. So, you know,
That's fair.
Yeah, and it's not saying it's cool. I run church history stuff, so I'm not saying it's cool, but I do appreciate that. I feel fairly safe that, like, hey, I'm not a different guy. With that said, though, this one topic I've noticed has caused controversy every time it's come up, and it happened again this week where I tweeted out there was a conference with some different people, and I don't. When I do this tweet, I'm not attacking the people themselves. I'm never like, these people are bad. It's just, to me, these conferences that we have that are going around the internet, I believe have just gotten very, very expensive, where the tickets to go to this particular conference, to just, if one person wanted to go, or if you want, it was $200. If, you know, so if you bring your wife, that's $400. And this thing also, they had like a $50 singles mixer if you were a guy, but it was actually only $1 if you were a girl. All that to say, to me, it seemed like there were a lot of high prices. And this is, from my experience of looking at these conferences, this is a pretty common thing where it's usually $200, $250 to go to a conference. And what I had tweeted out was I don't want to say something to the effect. I want to try to read it as closely as I can. But I had basically said, my phone closed right when I pulled it up. Anyway, I had said, you know, this seems pretty expensive. These tickets have gotten pretty high. And when I look at Charles Spurgeon, when I look at who was the other guy? D.L. Moody, Jonathan Edwards, and R.A. Torrey, when they would go around and speak, they didn't charge anyone. You know, are these guys worth hundreds of dollars that we're going to listen to today when those greats from the past charged nothing? That's not exactly how I said it word for word, but again, my phone went off right when I went to read it. But that was extremely close. And again, comments went galore after the idea of basically people, and I can pretty much sum up almost all of the comments in two categories. And actually, even the people who were hosting the conference, who I like the people, I listened to one of their podcasts. We've had them on the show, but they were very upset with me for questioning the price of these conferences. And I'll put the two categories of where these things kind of go. Is usually they will say something to the effect of, conferences are expensive. You know, how cheap do you think you can make it? You know, that what kind of world do you live in where these conferences can be done for no money? And then the other category tends to be, hey, if we don't make it cost a lot of money, you won't value it as much. And so we make it, and I'm not saying like, this is actually the arguments, both of those exact arguments were made by the person who was defending themselves. Now, I'm not running this revived conversation with any intention of going like, hey, I'm going to defend myself on Twitter through a podcast. But I just think it's a very interesting topic. The way the church handles money today, and some of the things that we see the church doing are very unique.
First of all,
the time period we live in.
Yeah, let me first of all just say, like, from a operational standpoint, I feel like I agree with those arguments. You know, like, to play devil's advocate to you, conferences are expensive.
I like to point out, some people, just real quick, when Joel and I do a revived conversation, we don't plan this out. And I don't mean this, we don't plan it out as in, like, this is a disorganized mess. Like, Joel and I don't normally know where the other person stands. So, like, when we discuss things, it's happening in real time. This is not, I had a guy come up to me one time. I was like, how much of the revived conversation is scripted? And I was like, absolutely none of it. Like, this is, when we disagree, we're disagreeing not for camera. Like, we're disagreeing because we are coming at this from different perspectives.
Yeah, this is a text message the night before that says, hey, do you want to talk about money in the how churches operate on a revived conversation? And I say, sure, that sounds like a great topic. And then here we are. Oh, so am I still playing? Are you waiting on me to play?
Yeah, I was waiting on you. We're waiting for you.
Yeah. Yeah. So, again, from an operational, and this is kind of my first question I have for you, is because conferences are expensive. In our current society, in our current setup, you know, especially if there's food at them, you know, there's people preparing food, there's people serving food, there is greeters, there's staff, there are cleaning crews that have to come through and clean that whole building after they're done. If there is a speaker coming in from out of town, they're almost certainly paying to put that speaker up, covering his travel expenses. And then there is something to you kind of pay for what you get as far as the you want people that are interested. You don't want people that are just wandering in and couldn't care less about what's going on there. But it was free, so you know what? Let me show up type of thing and mooch off of, you know, whatever goodie bags they're giving away at the front door. You want people that are genuinely interested there. And the easiest, fastest way to filter the people that are genuinely interested and aren't genuinely interested is to have them contribute towards it in some way or another. So from an operational standpoint, that makes sense to me. My question is, are you pushing back on this from a operational standpoint? Because again, I think we can maybe look at history and see how society and how we operate things have changed over the years and maybe give some validity to it on that front. Or, and I feel like this is the more interesting conversation, is this a Jesus flipping the tables type of conversation where we're upset about
all of the intelligence just left the room. Like, everyone who was like, oh, this will be an interesting discussion. Like, these people don't know what they're saying.
Yeah, is this a scenario in which Jesus would come in and flip tables?
Yeah, so it's okay. So I actually think we can talk about both. So let me start with operations, and I think as we kind of drift, maybe as we go, we'll move to that philosophical side of it, because I think there's a discussion to be had on both sides. So let me start with the operations perspective, and I'll start with the first one. People, you know, the guy in the comments, and I'm actually specifically not using his name, not because I'm not like trying to call him out or anything, but just like, I like this guy. We've gotten along in the past. I'm really not. Like, I don't want to cause a beef with him. Like, this episode is not attack the guy who attacked me on Twitter. That's definitely not what I'm doing. But I've had this argument so many times with people on Twitter that at this point I was like, I think it needs to be discussed a little bit. But the idea here is basically, we have to feed our family. You know, literally the guy said, we have to feed the employees that work for us. We have to, you know, we have these costs, right? But let's look at Spurgeon or Moody or Tory or Whitfield or Edwards or any of those people. Are we going to say that they also did not have costs in their day as well? That they also didn't need venues? That they didn't need to feed people? And I will say, if a conference feeds you and provides you lodging and you're buying tickets that cover those things, I definitely think that's a very different scenario than what most of the conferences I have seen, which is you're paying $200 to go to the conference. In the same way that the people who are putting on the conference are saying, well, we have other bills. We have to pay the speakers, the goodie bags, et cetera. Well, I would also challenge those people and say, but the people coming to your conference have to pay lodging. they have to pay fuel if they travel. If they have to fly, they have to pay airplane tickets. They also have to pay for the food of themselves when they get there. If my wife and I fly to a nearby conference, if it's not even very far, I mean, this is going to add up to be hundreds, if not thousands of dollars. Are you confident that you are giving something that is worth thousands of dollars when I compare it to church history and I see people like Jonathan Edwards, Charles Spurgeon, D.L. Moody, and all just, the list could go on, who never charged anybody, who they would do it for free. George Whitefield would, granted, he'd go out into a field, but is that maybe what the church should be willing to do? Yes, a lot of people would be uncomfortable perhaps going out into a field, but maybe that's the cost of doing ministry. What is the goal of these things? Is it simply to break even and to have a conference where we talk about a bit? I mean, because they're almost always a biblical theological subject. They're very rarely, if I can be, in my last year of basically tracking these and talking about them, I don't think I've ever seen one that was evangelistic. They're always just a subject, you know. At what point do we say we've drifted from what was historically being done? If we go back in church history, we see lots and lots of outreach revivals, and whether you disagree with the revival tent methods, and maybe say, I don't, you know, there are lots of people who disagree with that, but there are lots of different things where people are moving from place to place and they're speaking at different churches, but they're almost always evangelistic messages or messages to encourage the body. This idea of the conference, of bringing around the experts to talk about marriage or to talk about an eschatology or to talk about heresy or whatever, you know, whatever the flavor is, that's a very, very new phenomena that started around the same time that corporate conferences that we see around the, you know, the country on different subjects started. And I can't help but wonder if maybe the church has gotten kind of caught up in chasing this worldly way of doing things and maybe should slow down and ask themselves, is this the way that we should be doing? Yes, the world likes to do conferences as well, but is it necessarily the best thing when we're charging people lots of money, especially because when I think of these conferences, you know, and especially a lot of them are theological, I'm thinking of the man, the associate pastor at the rural church, or, you know, the guy who's the youth pastor who wants to be a pastor someday. The people who probably could most benefit from these conferences are usually the people who are priced out the most. Like the guy who volunteers for Sunday school, he could really use some of the materials from this conference. He could really use meeting and talking to some of these, you know, big names probably. But the $400 price tag plus travel, lodging, and food is going to certainly, in a lot of these cases, price them out. And I go, that it feels weird to me that that's where we're at when historically, for, you know, 1900 years of church history, we've never let pricing keep people from hearing thoughts on God's word. And here's historically how, in case you're wondering, so historically, how would you do it? How would you do it? Well, tended to be George Whitefield's coming to town, the church sends him an invitation. And then the church does everything it can to raise the money to help him so that George Whitefield is taking on as little personal cost as possible. However, George Whitefield might take on some personal cost, and he would have people, maybe supporters, donors, and stuff back home that would help him so that he's not going to be broke on the road. And he might be also selling books and stuff along the way. And then when he gets there and he gives his speaking, it would not be uncommon for the church to perhaps do a free will offering or do their, maybe some of the richer people in the church to kind of, you know, catch George Whitefield. Thank you so much for coming. Here's some help for what you're doing so you can get on to the next place. Now, that may not sound very organizational and it might not sound very systematic. It might even sound a little insecure, but that actually is historically how most of the movement throughout time, and those were great movements. The Great Awakening would have operated under that model where people are not going to be sure where their next check comes from. George Whitefield and Jonathan Edwards and John Wesley were not putting a price tag. You didn't have to pay for a ticket to come and see them speak. And okay. Go ahead.
The world is exponentially smaller than it was in the 1800s. I'm not going to deny that the modern secular world has almost certainly contributed towards the psychology and the structure of how churches operate, especially larger, richer, more mega church-like structures function very much as a business. And I think there is a lot of great arguments on how this is not a great thing for the American church. However, there, I think there's a pretty big difference between what you're describing in the 1800s and what is the reality
is it?
Of our
whoa,
culture.
Whoa, whoa.
It is.
Is it? I will push back because, Joel, you and I both know a lot of missionaries, and you know how they get their funding? How do they do what they do? How do they get the money to go overseas?
They raise
how
their
do
support.
They do it exactly the method we pretty much just described, don't they? They go to different places, they speak, and they rely on God to bring supporters to them. Now, we just if missionaries are expected to live pretty much under that same model, now unless you're IMB, there are certain missionary groups that do pay for you, but if missionaries are expected to live under that same old 1800s model, why have we kind of exempted the pastor conference speakers from that model?
Because in the 1800s, I mean, when Whitfield was coming to your town, you got the barrier to entry is a 3-hour wagon ride through a prairie. Like it wasn't you didn't have a whole lot of things to be in. Or sorry, the struggle of being alive in the 1800s was the barrier entry. If people wanted to hear George Whitfield, it was hard enough. Like, the people that were there were the people that wanted to be there, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Whereas today, the people that, and again, this is a nitpick of a very specific subset of qualifications that is one of the reasons for a barrier to entry for a conference. But I'm saying, to stumble across a live stream online and watch something is a very different barrier to entry than loading up the wagon with supplies because George Whitfield is talking 3 towns over and you want to be there, so you have to leave at 4 a.m. to be able to get there by Sunday service. Those are very different levels of effort to go into something. And there are, again, the world is small. There's plenty of resources for people that do want free and ready access to sound theological teaching. They can access that if they are motivated and interested to do so. But churches back then had a different environment, had a different structure, had a different audience that they were interacting with that I feel it would not...
I'm going to say, this has been the model for hundreds and hundreds of years of church history. It has been the model up until recently. And I agree with you. The barrier for entry has gotten easier, but also the barrier for travel. The speaker doesn't have to cross the Atlantic on a rickety boat. The speaker can oftentimes get in a car and drive 4 to 5 hours to have the conference. We have many, many wonderful churches across America, many of which maybe they can't host 2,000 people. Maybe your conference won't be quite as large as it could have been, but they could host lots of people still and bring lots of people in. Like I would argue that the fact that things are smaller, that we're more connected, is actually a reason that the prices should be going down, not up.
Well, and so that brings to the other kind of topic you were talking about. These historically were primarily evangelical events. They were outreach events. Modern day, as you mentioned, they're really not that anymore. They are more specific theologically minded training events. They are not that ministry's primary ministry. They are like a secondary thing.
True.
It's a triage of resources that they're deciding, why not make this conference self-sustaining so that we can dedicate the funds that we currently have towards our primary ministry in those ways. And because they can, because it is, people will pay for it, and it does weed out the people that are interested, it creates a self-sustaining thing that allows it to operate indefinitely moving forward. It's not something that they have to dedicate resources to finding ways to fundraise money for. It can function independently.
Okay, so I do agree with what you're saying in the sense of these are aimed at Christians. And I would like to say, look, if you're spending, you know, if you've spent $200 on a conference ticket, you're not a bad person, of course. Certainly a lot better spending $200 on a conference ticket than a lot of other things you can spend on. So this is not in any way a criticism of the people buying it. But I would say, you're right. We've moved away from evangelistic outreaches to do these conferences on certain theological topics. And this might be the part of the show now where we kind of drift away from the operational perspective and we start to kind of move now towards the why are we doing this perspective? What is the goal of these things? Because for me, I find it a little strange. And I know, and you could argue seminaries and Bible colleges have been doing this for a very long time. And it's true, they have been. But I do find it a little strange that I'm reading the Word of God and I go, oh, wow, I have found some great content. I've found some deeper understanding. I should go charge people to listen to me to share that with them. Like, I think that is a very strange perspective. Now, sure, the church has been selling books for a very long time. And that is something that I think is perfectly reasonable to do. But what the church has not been doing, and that is a very recent development in church history, we have not been charging people to hear people speak about theological and spiritual concepts. That you go back to the 1800s, you go back to even the early 1900s, that was not a thing. If a pastor or a professor or one of those people wanted to give a lecture on an idea or a subject or talk about a concept, they would just go do it and they might organize it and stuff. But it was very rarely an expense. Certainly if they were hosting it and they did charge you, which I don't think they tended to do, but if they did, it would be very, very cheap. Because they want to get their content, their information, their stuff out there. And then, yes, perhaps they might sell books and stuff along the side.
It's because they have to advertise for months and twist people's arms just to try to get people to make the journey to come and hear them. Like, it's a different problem than what we have today.
No, not true. If you're in London and they're giving a giant seminar, there are millions of people in London who are going to come. Like, that's not... not going to come. They're not all going to come to the conference. But you know what I'm saying? Like, you're not... Not every single... time a speaker came to town that they had to lift the wagons and go 6 hours. In fact, people were bored back then. They didn't have, you know, TV and stuff. A lot of times they were interested in the most recent lectures. And if you lived in London and somebody was giving a lecture, you would go check it out. So you certainly could have made money charging them, but they just didn't do that. It wasn't seen as something that the church should do. And for most of church history, that was the case.
That's the interesting part. I've seen something as the church should do. Because, again, from an operational standpoint, as you've gathered, I don't have any problem with this. It makes sense to me, and I'm happy to pay to be a part of it. I'm happy to enable that conference to exist. The more interesting conversation is, yes, where are we going to draw the line now?
Thought I'll throw on the operational perspective, and this might be opinion, and if you're listening... I will say it is a little dangerous to throw this out based on my experience on Twitter. People are very defensive of their conferences. So, you know, we might be getting emails and comments on this. Hopefully people think this is fair. But I would just say, if the only way for you to give a conference on, and I'm not even going to pick one of the conferences that I've seen. I'm going to just make one up. A conference on heresy. Let's say it's a conference on heresy. You're going to give a conference on heresy. If the only way for it to go forward is for you to charge people $200 per ticket in a time when eggs cost like $5. Like, it's not an economically good time, right? If that's the only way for you to go forward with your conference, I would argue maybe you need to question whether this is the best way to talk about heresy or whatever your subject is. As you said, live streams are free. Twitter spaces are free. TikTok is free. There are lots of ways. We're running a podcast. It's not free, but it's a lot cheaper than $200 per head. Maybe you need to reconsider what model you're using to get your message out, because that if it's that expensive and we're someday going to be asked by, you know, we're going to, our how we spend our money is important. And you're saying, I need to ask the average person to spend $200 just to get here. That doesn't include if they do anything extra. And that doesn't include their lodging, their travel, their food and their money and all that. I got to say, like, that seems like a really expensive burden for what you're going to give them. Now, maybe it's justifiable, but you're putting, like you said, these aren't evangelistic. You're telling Christian brothers and sisters in Christ, I think that it is good for you to put this much money into this thing. And I do got to go and say, okay, how confident are you? Because, again, church history would say that wasn't normal.
I agree with what you're saying there. The thing is, the people that are doing that are not the people that are... The people that you're describing are not the people that are hosting $200 per person conferences. There are, it's again, different approaches to resource management. The people that are typically doing these conferences, it is a secondary ministry that they understand people will come for because they know the audience, they know the reach, and they have decided to let that conference exist in a self-sustained way because they want to put their resources towards other projects, whereas there are different training business models. That's not the right phrasing. There are different models of establishment that lean into free and steady access to everyone and, you know, rely on Patreon or for people to support them other ways to create that publicly accessible content that is also a very valid way to, you know, put those lectures and information out there as well. And I'm not saying one is better than the other. I like the free stuff. That's nice.
I do want to point out too, our show runs a Patreon. We do also have a shirt shop that occasionally moves the occasional shirt. I am not against people selling books. Historically speaking, it's done. It's a thing that the church has always been a part of. So I don't want this to be seen, oh, so you think, you know, because people are going to write and say, oh, so you want to muzzle the ox. No, I don't. I'm not trying to say that you can't sell shirts or you can't sell products. I do think it's strange to sell a speech. And that is the part where I am going, hold up.
Yeah, why are we drawing the line there?
Because point to me one instance in scripture or in church history before about 50 years ago where people would do that, where we would say, come to my speech and you have to pay money to come through the door. Like, that is a very new phenomenon that we all seem to have embraced without any questioning of it, but it's a super new thing that didn't exist until not that long ago. And I will be honest, it does not, I don't think it's quite biblical, but I also think it's outside of our history as well to do it. I don't think that this is a good direction.
I'm certainly not denying that it's outside of our history. I will agree that it is a modern phenomenon, but I feel like it is a byproduct of our increased communications and our increased population. It makes sense that this would be a natural evolution of how information would be structured in presentations like this. It doesn't surprise me one bit. How many people were in America in 1850? You know, I don't know off the top of my head.
Between 40 to 50 million, but that actually is probably low. So that's probably more than that.
All right. Against our, you know, pushing 350 million that we have today, that we are so much more saturated and we have so much more communication today. It makes sense to me that this would be when churches and ministries are deciding how they want to spend their resources and manage stuff. It makes sense to me that this would be one of the things that they let be self-sustaining.
So I guess my question on this idea is, yes, from a business perspective,
right,
I completely agree on why you might do this, but I'm not asking from a business perspective either. Like, I'm hearing you say basically say like, hey, yeah, well, I can see why this would have started. I'm not disagreeing with why it started. I'm disagreeing with whether it should have started maybe in the first place and whether it's the best way to keep going. You mentioned that a lot of these are parachurch organizations, right, who are using these conferences to fund other activities. But if the way that you're funding
they're not necessarily using them to fund other activities, but they're letting them be self-sustaining so that they have more resources to fund what they want to fund.
They're not footing the cost for them. If the way that you foot the cost or fund things is by putting a rather large burden on Christians who are coming to learn from you, and I find that to be a little bit, you know, not necessarily the best way to do things. Now, with that said, a lot of us know that there are Bible colleges and seminaries, right, that they also tend to cost money. But the difference would be that when you leave a Bible college or a seminary, you go out with a degree that allows you to get jobs and to do things. Like, there's a product at the end of that on top of all the training and learning. And if there was a Bible college or a seminary that just jacked up their prices through the roof, granted, they would probably not be competitive. But if you go to that Bible college or a seminary and you go, why are these prices too high? And they simply say, well, we could run things for cheaper. However, we found that you were willing to pay this much, and so we're going to put this much burden on you because this is what you're willing to pay. Not because it's actually what's best for the ministry and not because this is what the granted purpose is. It's just that we found that you were willing to pay this much, and so that's what we're going to do. And I go, man, that sounds like not what a Bible college and a seminary should do. And in the same way, conventions are designed, conferences, the idea is we're going to teach you something. You're going to learn something from having these speakers come, and then you may also pay to maybe help it out. But when it gets to be very high prices that I think puts a burden on people, I would go, that seems to me not to be a great thing to do, just simply because people are willing to pay you know, that much money. Does that mean as Christians and as people who are ministering, especially these, you know, a secular conference, whatever they're going to do, they're going to do. But as Christians, should we be running conferences at such exorbitant fees simply because people are willing to pay that much?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. Again, I feel like we're kind of talking a little bit in circles. I feel like it's a little bit of a different conversation, though, than our flipping church tables conversation, though, because in these scenarios, the church is, well, I suppose there's overlap there. It's different than the church bookstore or the church coffee shop or True. Church fundraisers, you know, that are making yeah. money, you know, that we can have our own conversation around whether or not that is biblical, because this is teachings, right? So like that's a different interaction than just a pure profit approach.
So if we're talking in terms of like ecclesiology, we're just thinking the church, we're moving kind of away from, you know, pastor, speaker, traveling conferences, but we're moving towards the idea of what can the church do. That does, I also think, get to the kind of a different situation as well, where you're, you know, the church coffee shop, or, you know, in the church school, the church, you know, the church fundraiser for the youth trip. There are so many different things that the church does today. And I will say, historically speaking, from what I can tell, a lot of those things seem kind of valid. Now, there are, actually, this just came to me. There used to be what was called the church pew, where you would pay, and maybe you've heard of this too, Joel, mm-hmm. where you would pay to have a pew inside the church, and that would be your pew. And people, you know, these were the nice seats, and these rich families would buy pews and put their name on it. And
well, that's how you supported the church. That's how you tithed.
It was one of the, yeah, that was one. But I always think that was kind of wild, because if there was any way that you could pick how to support the church, I feel like the way that goes almost directly against James 2, where it says the rich sit here in a good spot, and the poor mm-hmm. sit over there in a bad spot. I was like, that's almost exactly what I feel like James was kind of saying, don't do. And yet a lot of churches, and for a long time, the church practiced this because it was a practical way to make money. You know, it was very practical. It worked very well. It was effective. And yet it also wasn't great. And there's a reason I don't think really any churches do this anymore. And they realize this is kind of going against scripture. Even though it's practical, it is also not really good. And it doesn't look good to have this, mm-hmm. you know, these nice pews reserved for the people who put money in, but the poor can go sit over there. There is, I think, a conversation to be had sometimes about whether or not, just because you can do something, whether or not you should be doing that. The church pew is probably a really good example of something that you can do. I think James would be a very direct attack on whether you can or cannot do it. But a bunch of churches did do it, and they thought it was fine, and it was considered normal. But over time, they realized this doesn't look good, and it wasn't actually what they were supposed to be doing.
How would you manage high demand lecture if you were in charge of that at your church? How would you manage the RSVP situation here?
Sure. Okay, so I'm at a church. Let's imagine a picture. I am now running a church. For starters, if I'm going to have speakers come, there's a very high chance I'm going to be running like an evangelistic one. I'm going to be like, get everyone in here so they can hear the gospel, because that's what the church used to be doing.
That's already not what we're talking about, though.
I know, but I'm just saying that I think is worth pointing out, though, that we have slipped and we have changed our lens. But if we're going to move from that subject, I'm going to host a Revive Thoughts conference. We're doing it. The Revive Thoughts conference is here, and it's going to be just a cheap $5,000 ticket for you to get extraordinary insights from Joel. It was actually funny. Somebody actually in the comments said, basically, well, the good news is if you guys ever host a conference, I know based on your opinions, it's going to be cheap.
That's a great question. We've talked about doing a live event for years and years and years.
Yeah. 100%
love that. Are you saying that we're committing to a free, no cost entry?
How about this? I will commit right now to saying tickets won't be $200. All right, they're not going to be on that level.
Why charge anything though? It sounds like on principle you're against charging anything.
Yeah, honestly, I would love to be able to say we are hosting a free Revive Thoughts Church History Conference. Some people might hear that and go, "Oh, it's free. It doesn't mean anything." But I feel, you know, some people are also going to hear church history conference and go, why?
So I think we might fall into this category that are wanting anyone and everyone to come. So,
But I will say, my goal would be, let's go to donors. Let's go to people who might be interested in supporting this project. Let's go to churches that are maybe interested in hosting this. How can we keep the costs on this as bare minimal for everybody involved? And let's find out what, you know, who are the speakers that are going to come, and let's see what we can do to get as much possible as this put down through donations and through even our own personal costs if it comes to it. Because I would rather have a small conference with not that many people, but the burden be very low, and that the people themselves can get as good a teaching as we can give. I would rather do that than put on a conference where a lot of people show up and we make a lot of money. I just, you know, I just have to question that model. And maybe it's my lifestyle. Maybe it's the way I view money and the way I view the church. It is possible that my view is wrong and I'm on the wrong side of this. I've been wrong on things in the past, but I would aim for the, if I had to go smaller, I would go smaller versus making more money.
Interesting. So fast forward 10 years from now, Revive Thoughts is a huge mega company where we have millions of followers and our
10
live
years,
events.
It won't take that long. Give it 4. Okay. Yeah.
Our live events have become so popular to the point where, you know, the demand is so high. We got 50,000 people. We have to rent out stadiums. We have to pay for stadiums. We have to pay for, you know, all of our valets and, you know, all the fees that come across with that. And people are eager to come and hear us speak. There's no way, you know, like donations themselves would sustain and tour.
How did George Mueller keep his orphanage
again,
going?
Again.
How did Hudson Taylor reach millions of people for China? How do a lot of us overseas do things overseas?
They did it by living by faith in a very unpredictable lifestyle that it's not in accordance with planning an event 9 months out, right?
No,
which is what you would
faith,
have to do.
Faith worked back then, but it doesn't work now. I'm going to challenge
and push back on
that.
Faith works, but the venue that needs their utility bill of $20,000 paid.
100%. Here's my answer to that. If this is in God's will, if we are trying to do it, again, we're going to keep costs as low as humanly possible, if not free, which is the goal. And I'm gonna put it out there. I'm going to be reaching out to God and praying and asking people to join us in prayer and saying, we have this opportunity to run this giant conference or whatever. There's zillions of people who are listening to Revive Thoughts. They want in, but we need this much money to do so. And if we don't get it donated, we don't get it brought in, and the difference between us running the conference or not is charging everyone $200, I would say maybe don't run the conference.
This is the difference in psychology of I'm using business model in air quotes, but the people that are running these conferences and people like you have the same goal. They genuinely care about the content. They think it genuinely is interesting, genuinely can change lives. It's not that they're selfish and want to make a ton of money. I mean, there certainly probably are selfish people that are you know, gaming the system. But in general, these are two avenues to achieve the same goal, and one where the attendees pay money towards it is a more stable and more expandable system moving forward in the future. With a donations-based system, you're very limited as far as how far out you can plan and also how many events you could actually schedule. Those are limitations you wouldn't have in the other model.
I mean,
from the mind point of someone that says, how can I reach the most amount of people? That model is severely handicapped and bottlenecked. Would you agree with that?
I wouldn't. I would say I can think of two different names right now of pastors who do go around speaking. They almost never charge, and they are using the model. And one of them is quite a big name, I would say. That they don't tend, sometimes it does go to conferences where they charge, but they don't tend to go to conferences that charge. Secondly, you might be right on a business perspective. You might be, I'm not disgranting you the idea that from a business perspective, but is the church supposed to operate in the same paradigms as a business? Are we supposed to just look and use our funding and our resources as the way that a business runs things? Yeah. And I will say,
that is the exact conversation that happens in every meeting in the modern day American church every single month.
I, if you recall, I was in a church for 2 years and I was also a part of those conversations. I know. And I will say the other thing too is maybe it's also time for us to consider that the conference maybe has seen its day. Maybe it is time for us, if the only way for us to do these conferences is to charge hundreds and hundreds of dollars on, again, these people, maybe it's time for us to consider, as a church, we're thoughtful, creative people, maybe it's time for us to consider new ways to get our information out and to do it for at a much lower price. Because like you said, the world is much closer, the world is much smaller. Maybe it is time for us to let go of this thing that, quite frankly, was created by the world, that had its heyday, honestly, a little bit, I would almost argue, a little while ago. And maybe it's time to branch into new avenues of getting our content out and perhaps also raising the support that we need to do so at the same time. Maybe this is an area where we need to let it go.
Okay, I got a question for you. I do find this a very interesting conversation. This spills over into more than just conferences, though. Your approach to this, your mindset, with your logic, all of these churches should be selling their coffee and their books at cost, right? They should be not making any money.
So, if I'm using church history as an example, I would say, because again, and I don't know, scripture does not say you cannot sell books. I don't see that. Scripture also does not say you can't host conferences. But when I look at church history, it is very common for people to sell books. It is very common for people to sell items. That is historically something that has been going on for a very long time. It's not brand new. And so I look at that and I go, okay, we have a precedent for this that's very old. It goes as far back as we can remember. Books have used to be very expensive, so it makes sense they'd have to sell them. And even when books came down in prices, it was still very common for pastors and such to sell them. An example is Charles Spurgeon. Charles Spurgeon sold his sermons and his books, and he made at least enough of a profit that he was able to tell Metropolitan Tabernacle, I don't need a salary. I will preach for free. I make enough money based on my books. So I don't want to do that. I'm not going to take a salary from you. So I look at that and I go, okay, we have a very long precedent of people doing this. I mean, pretty much every pastor we've had on this show has written a book and sold it. I mean, maybe not all of them, but I mean, nearly all of them have, right? Mm-hmm. This is something that's very long and has gone on for a long time. And it's a product. I look at that and I go, okay, I can see why I think that would be fair.
Troy, so just purely just on the precedence of church history is why you're giving that a pass.
I mean, we don't have a scriptural, biblical thing exactly to point to, right? We don't. So I'm using church history on the subject of selling books. We don't have a scriptural thing, but we do have lots of pastors throughout church history who have done it. It's not something that's brand new. And I look at that and I go, okay. Now, I would say, let me ask you a question, Joel. Mm-hmm. Do you think a pastor should write a book on a topic? Let's go very biblical. Let's say this pastor is going to do an exegesis on 1 Timothy. Should a pastor write that book solely to sell it and make money?
Let me ask you a question. And to answer your question, why don't we sell our t-shirts at cost? Right? We have a product, and with that profit, we produce a show that we want to reach more people. And through the selling of merchandise, absolutely, it enables us to be more effective at our reach and allows us to produce this, right? How is that different? Why aren't we selling our t-shirts at cost? Because it sounds like, to me, from your approach, we shouldn't be making money on those t-shirts, but we use those to help fund our podcast.
No. Let me clarify, because you're not actually the first person to point that out. I got that point out in the comments section by a few different people. A product is different than a speech on theology. So, for example, if I sell a shirt, I mean, you and I bought a shirt from a friend of ours who ran a t-shirt company. I don't know if you remember a friend of ours who ran a t-shirt company. I bought that shirt. I still wear that shirt to work out. It has a little hole under the armpit now, so it is getting closer to its end, but it's a very small hole. And so I still run in that shirt probably 3 or 4 times, you know. Well, I don't run every week 3 or 4, but I've run in it 3 or 4 times this week.
Totally.
That is a product. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
you've
exactly
had three runs.
Thank you. But no, I have, that is a product. Everyone needs shirts. I don't think there's anything wrong with saying, hey, our ministry, Revive Studios is kind of a complicated one. Which one do you put it in? But I would say more ministry, because we're not, you and I have not taken a paycheck on this. Our model is selling these shirts. There's a slight amount of profit in it, but the slight is a key word there.
Yeah.
If you'd like the shirts for these designs, we think they're great. Go wear them and tell people where you got them. That sounds fun to us. If we sold our shirts, which I don't remember how much they cost, but if we sold these shirts with the average shirt at the store is $10, maybe? I don't know.
Bro, no. We're like $25, $30, $40 range.
You can really see I live overseas now and I'm not I'm not invested. Okay, so let's say the average shirt is $40. If I go around selling that shirt for $120 and I say, but it's a great Revive Studio shirt, what is your first impression going to be? Is it going to be, wow, it must take $120 to run Revive Studios? Or, as an outsider, are you going to go, I'm not sure if that's above reproach. I'm questioning whether you're selling those shirts at such a high markup, perhaps to make money for yourself.
But it's still making money either way. Whether or not you're being egregious about it or not, you're still doing it to make money. That is still the motivation behind
I have never said that selling products to make money for your business or your ministry is necessarily wrong. I don't think that there is anything wrong with selling a product, an item, a thing.
But like, that's what these theological books that these theologians are selling
are. Books, I'm also a fan of. I've never said I had a problem with people selling theological books, but why do you write the book? When it comes to theology, when it comes to God's word, if you're writing a book on gardening and you're great at gardening and you're a pastor and you go, I sold a book on gardening, it's awesome, I'm going to sell it for a bunch of money and make a bunch of money, and you do it, great. But if you're writing a book on 1 Timothy, if you're writing a book on God's word and your pure goal is to just make a bunch of money on it, I don't think that's good. And I don't think that God's leaders, who are supposed to be above reproach and who James 3:1 says, you know, not many of you should wish to be teachers because you know will be judged more strictly. I don't think that necessarily is something that people should be doing.
I mean, they're not writing it purely just to make money. They're writing it because they love the content and they want people to know about the content. Okay. And they know it can sustain them as in life goals.
And that's why my question was, would it be okay to write that book purely to make money? Just, you're like, I need to make money. I've got a lot of stuff.
But I don't think that's a very realistic, all these people that are writing books.
Well,
so what's the difference between a theological author that writes commentaries, right? You have, I'm not going to name drop a bunch of commentaries. you have your commentary authors. They're very good at what they do. They have great insights to it. We love them. We have the whole collection here on the bookshelf, you know, of our favorite commentary that clearly loves what they do, loves communicating this knowledge, and is able to sustain themselves in life. They pay the bills with monies they make on these book sales from these commentaries. How is that different than the gentleman who does essentially the exact same thing, except by voice behind a podium as he travels as a speaker?
A book, I believe, is a product that you put on a shelf that requires a printing press and other things to get behind it. And has, as I said, 1900 years or so of church history backing the idea that pastors write books and sell them. And yes, they take some of the proceeds for their effort, for their work. To create a book, it is a labor to create a product. But a convention speaker, is not creating a product. Imagine, let me just look at this. They are creating a product.
It's the exact same content being conveyed in both ways.
So let me ask you, if a person comes to church tomorrow and says, I would like to preach about Christ crucified, and not tomorrow, well, I don't know, whenever you're listening to this, it's Sunday, right? And you go to church and you show up and the guy's going, I'm going to preach about Christ crucified, or I'm going to teach about Revelation today. And you're like, oh, cool. And he's like, $20 to take your seat. You're going to go, what? No.
Again, that's different.
Why is it different for a convention?
Because it's evangelical. What you're describing is evangelical, which should always be free.
No. Okay, so we should always say that the church doors are open and for free, and I'm completely in agreement with you. But if we put the label convention over it and we're charging our brothers and sisters in Christ, now we can charge them whatever amount we want. That doesn't seem like the way that the church is supposed to use teachings.
You're not.
God.
You're
like,
not.
That seems strange.
You're not paying for the convention. You're paying for that specific speaker's specific analysis and take and presentation and the arrangement of the information that he's presenting, much like he would in a book that you would also be happy purchasing.
But a except book here, is a product.
You get to hear him. But the presentation is a product. They're both products. They're both products. We can agree to disagree on this one, but I feel like if you go to a marriage conference, you know, and the couple, again, is well-respected for their unique approach intake to it, whether those thoughts are being conveyed through words on a page or through a choreographed, thought-out presentation lecture in person, that is still the same product. It's just a different medium.
Up until very recently throughout history, these people would go from place to place. They would speak. They would get there. They would, after they spoke, if you liked what you heard and you wanted to support them, you would either give them a donation or you would buy their books. And that was how, up until extremely recently in church history and in just history in general, these people were supported. And I think it is not above reproach. I don't think it makes the church look good that many of our Christian speakers are now going around and doing it for $200 per conference. And again, this is not to aim at any one person. This is across the board. Lots of people are doing it. And what's actually interesting, and I have actually looked this up, probably some of the most famous people who in the church are known, like we don't tend to use names on here, so I won't. But when you think of a person, and you think of a rich prosperity preacher, and you're probably picturing one of a handful of people, and there's one that's very well known for being a prosperity preacher. I actually went and looked up because I was curious. I was like, is this, you know, how much does he charge to speak? And what I was shocked to find is he actually does it for free. And most of those prosperity preachers that you, when you are thinking of the guys who go out there and go to a conference and they're going to be getting money from the people, most of them do it for free. And I feel really weird that prosperity preachers are going around America and going around speaking for free, but solid men of God who are giving theological concepts that people should want to go to are charging $200 a ticket. And I just go, that feels weird to me that that's where we're at in the church right now. Is there not a better way and a better method to go about this than that?
Okie dokie.
And that might be where we end
to leave it there, yeah.
Yep. All right, well, you can write in nicely. Don't want to hurt my feelings too much here on who, you know, mate, what do you think? And yes, you please know, I mean, this is just my qualifier. We are giving our opinions. We're not personally attacking anyone or any personal group. In fact, we tend to go out of our way not to use names here because we're not that show. And do know that these are opinions. We understand that we understand the arguments back and forth. We understand that you may disagree with us. That is great. We look forward to hearing from you, and we hope that you enjoyed this back and forth discussion between Joel and I. And yeah, let us know what you're thinking. And if you've recently paid for a conference, please don't get mad at me and go, oh, thanks a lot, Troy. No, I don't think you're a bad person. If you've recently hosted a conference, I don't think you're a bad person either. I'm just trying to get the church to question in general the direction and where we're going with our money. This turned into not exactly the episode I think Joel and I thought about. So maybe we might have to save it for another rainy day where we have a discussion on, you know, church cafes and church bookshops and church fundraisers and stuff like that.
ReviveThoughts@gmail.com. ReviveThoughts@gmail.com. It's in the description down below. Email us your thoughts. We're fascinating to find out what you're thinking about this topic. We'd love to hear. Also, feel free to reach out to us on social media. But until next time, Troy, do you have anything else? I think we're wrapped.
No, we appreciate you for listening. We thank so many of you who do put in the time to listen to this. We hope you enjoyed this back and forth discussion, and we hope that you weren't, you know, at any point yelling at your speakers or wherever you are. All right, this is Troy and Joel, and you are listening to Revive Thoughts.